Kaffee in seiner besten Form mit der neuen Cubo One Kapselmaschine von Chibo. In jeder Cubo-Kapsel steckt Spitzenkaffee aus besonderen Anbaugebieten. Für Espresso, Kaffeecrema oder Kaffee Grande auf Knopfdruck. Die neue Cubo One überzeugt mit Premium-Design, kompakter Größe und kleinem Einstiegspreis ab 29 Euro. Dank innovativer Press-Brew-Technologie wird jede Tasse besonders aromatisch mit samtiger Crema. Entdecke jetzt die Cubo-Kapselmaschinen in deiner Chibo-Filiale und auf chibo.de.
Stu does America.
Welcome to the program. We've got a good one for you tonight. David Bahnsen is going to join us to talk about the healthy work-life balance we should all have. Good luck with that. By the way, he actually thinks work should be part of that. Can you believe this guy? But we start by doing the left's tariff hypocrisy. It's so fascinating to see this because the left, I don't know, do you ever feel like you wake up one day in the morning and you're just like, gosh, like I understand the world, I understand what's going on, I understand where people are on things, and then you get totally flipped upside down. I feel like that's where I am, honestly, looking at the news on a daily basis at this moment, particularly when I look back and I remember going through 20 years of broadcast and seeing left-wing union officials constantly praising the benefits of tariffs and hating free trade and all their politicians that they pay constantly and donate money to, echoing and parroting those views. And then when Donald Trump comes in and he's like, hey, and he's being consistent, by the way, he's believed this since the 80s. He's been on the side of these union officials, since way back in the day. He's not a big union guy, obviously, but he's had agreement on this particular issue of tariffs with big union leaders and left-wing politicians. And so he comes into office and he implements a much more, I would say, stark version of the tariff regime than his first term. And all of a sudden, the left is like, oh, gosh, we hate tariffs. We can't believe it. Free trade's the way to go. I mean, I don't believe it for a second. And it's going to the second they get back in control, they'll probably, as soon as Trump is gone, they will flip-flop on this, I'm sure. Scott Jennings pointed this out. Scott Jennings finds it amusing that Trump's tariffs have suddenly turned Democrats into free traders. Every once in a while, this happens, and Trump is probably the best of all time at it. If he says something, the Democrats will find a way to disagree with it. Even if it's like, I mean, they wouldn't even clap for the like kid who like recovered from cancer at the State of the Union, right? Like he can make them hate anybody, which is really, really fascinating. But the question, I guess, for us is as conservatives, is it the right way for us to go? Should we just look at their hypocrisy and say, hey, maybe there's a path here to implement more free trade agreements? Or is it something where we're going the opposite way? We're going to go the same way as those left-wing politicians and union leaders from the past who really wanted these policies to come in. There's a real disagreement inside the White House about this, and that's starting to flame up in a big way right now. Tariff tales, borrowing from the Biden book, from National Review piece from Andrew Stutterford. Back a long, long time ago, Donald Trump was elected partly because of the surge in prices that marked Biden's time in office. The Biden administration attempted to deflect the blame for that inflation that marked his term with allegations of price gouging and greedflation. Remember this? FTC investigations were set in motion. I mean, that was an absurd excuse. We all knew that at the time. They basically tried to blame companies for that. Now, part of tariffs, and this is something you have to kind of take, if you believe there's good there, you have to take the good with the bad, is if you raise prices on foreign created products and they come to the United States, this is natural. Human beings do this. This is why, you know, our system is designed to try to take advantage of human tendencies and instincts. But like if you're running a business and you're charging $100 for your product and your neighbor down the street is they import foreign competitors and they also charge around $100. Maybe they charge $90 per product. They undercut you in price a little bit. And the tariff comes in and it solves that situation. They put a 50% tariff on there. All of a sudden they're charging $120, $130, $140. And you're at $100 and you're thinking to yourself, can I get away with $110? Can I get away with $115? I mean, I probably can, right? That's what happens every time tariffs are implemented like this. The American-owned and made products, first of all, a lot of times have to take pieces of their product that are made overseas and pay tariffs on those, so the cost goes up in reality. But also, they got a little room there, and they're going to do it. Now, do I think that's price gouging? No. Do I think that should be illegal? No. Do I think that's really even a problem? No, I think businesses should try to make as much money as they can for their companies, to pay their employees, to expand to their shareholders if they're a big enough company. I don't think there's any problem with that. That's capitalism. That's what they should do. We should get the government policies out of the way so they don't do it. But I don't think there's anything wrong with a company doing that if they're put in that position. And I think most companies will. We see that all the time. We saw that, you know, the washing machine tariffs, the tire tariffs from the Obama administration. We saw the same thing. Now, Andrew Ferguson, he's over at the FTC. He is kind of taking the same approach as when it comes to, I don't know, PR response to the negative outcomes of the tariffs when we're talking about markets falling and things like that. President Trump is reorienting our nation's economy to put Americans first as we adjust to the new economic order. I mean, I'm sorry. I've just gone through 20 years of talk radio when people said new world order and new economic order, and every talk radio listener ran and said panic when they heard those words. Now the Trump officials are just like, yeah, new economic order. They get used to it. New economic order. The FTC will be watching closely to make sure American companies are vigorously competing on prices. These necessary tariffs should not be interpreted as green light for price fixing or any other unlawful behavior. We will always protect American consumers. They should have used the term greedflation there just to kind of square the circle, because I think that would have been a lot of fun. This goes on to say, by tweeting out a warning at this time to our American companies, many of which will soon be struggling to adapt to what are likely to be severely disrupted supply chains, the FTC is transmitting an unmistakable signal. For many businesses, the rearrangement of supply chains will mean that their costs will increase. If that cost occurs, their margins will be depressed, leaving them with less money to innovate, invest, hire, pay their workers, and reward their shareholders. I don't think there's any question that that's going to happen at some level. The question is whether you think it's worth the trade-off. And I've talked to friends who are in the business of all sorts of different businesses, honestly. But a lot of them have to import some parts, or some part of their particular product comes in from overseas. And, you know, I mean, some of them have locked in contracts for manufacturing for multiple years. They can't just switch their supply chains and come to the United States next week. Like, they're going to, and the contracts they've signed are at certain prices. All their costs are going up. And so then I have to figure out, do I take less profit? Do I raise prices? Do I renegotiate these contracts? It really is difficult on businesses. And of course, the economy doesn't work its best when businesses are unsure of what's going on. Now, there's a massive disagreement inside the White House about this. On one side, you have people like Peter Navarro and J.D. Vance, who are much more friendly to these tariffs. And then you have other people like Elon Musk on the other side. Let's go through some of this. Here is J.D. Vance talking about what they're trying to do in the Trump administration.
Yeah, look, one bad day in the stock market compared to what President Trump said earlier today, and I think he's right about this, we're going to have a booming stock market for a long time because we're reinvesting in the United States of America. And more importantly than that, of course, the people in Wall Street have done well. We want them to do well. But we care the most about American workers and about American small businesses. And they're the ones who are really going to benefit from these policies. Think about how many factories we've seen close down since NAFTA in the early 90s, 90,000 American factories have been closed down. That's small towns that have been blighted. That's millions of workers who have lost their jobs. That has to stop.
And that's your wheelhouse.
President Trump, that is my wheelhouse.
That's where you're from.
I grew up in a town where you had 10,000 great American steel workers, and my town was one of the lucky ones. Now probably has 1,500 steel workers in that factory because you had economic policies that rewarded shipping our jobs to China instead of investing in American workers.
You know, J.D. Vance is much more populist than I am. I really like J.D. Vance, though. He's really smart and did an incredible job in the campaign as a vice presidential candidate. You know, once again, we're hearing terms that I'm associating with the left. I mean, how they always justify all of these policies with reinvestment. They always say that. They always say, we're reinvesting. No, everything's going to be great because we're taking that money and we're reinvesting it. Look, I mean, when you have tariffs, you have economic activity where money exchanges hands. When you take a tariff, you're taking some of that money away. And instead of that money going to the economy, it's going to the government. Now, they say they're going to reinvest it. I don't know. You believe that? I never believe that when government officials say that. But that's kind of where we are right now with that one. It's not my favorite policy of the Trump administration, but it is something that they believe in. And I got to say this, just totally separate. I'm only going by my own experience here. I had factory jobs. They sucked. Okay, I don't know. Everyone seems to love and make factory jobs sound like the best thing in the world. I did everything I could to get out of factories as fast as possible because I think it sucked. It's not to say that it's a bad job. There's nothing wrong with working there, but we used to kind of refer to it as back-breaking work. You know, how many of our fathers and grandfathers came back with, you know, they couldn't throw the ball in the backyard with you because their back hurt so much, or they had these injuries that they dealt with because of this difficult work. It is something to be proud of if you had to do it. But like, I don't know. I mean, I didn't have a lot of fun. I hated it. That's just my own thing. How about Lutnick? Lutnick is also talking on. He's again on the side of more tariffs, more protectionist measures to protect our trade. Here is Howard Lutnick.
The Treasury Secretary said on another network, we're going to hold the course. It's not the kind of thing you can negotiate away in days or weeks. That makes it sound like the tariffs are staying in place at least for days or weeks. Is that correct, or is the president considering postponing implementation to negotiate?
There is no postponing. They are definitely going to stay in place for days and weeks. That is sort of obvious. The president needs to reset global trade. Everybody has a trade surplus, and we have a trade deficit. We are paying away our future and our lives. The countries of the world are ripping us off, and it's got to end. The president has made it crystal, crystal clear. This is the policy we are going to protect. The factories that come build in America, we are going to protect them. They're going to be successful. That's why they're going to build in America, the greatest economy in the earth. All of these companies are going to come and build here.
All right. There you go. Sort of a great reset on trade. Elon Musk is on the other side of this. He's more of a free trade guy. I mean, part of this is he runs a lot of businesses. Sometimes he takes in components from overseas. His hope here is that these trade and tariff negotiations result in zero tariffs and these things just go away. Here's Elon Musk.
I'm hopeful, for example, with the tariffs that at the end of the day, I hope it is agreed that both Europe and the United States should move, ideally, in my view, to a zero tariff situation, effectively creating a free trade zone between Europe and North America. That's what I hope occurs. More freedom of people to move between Europe and North America. If they wish to work in Europe or wish to work in America, they should be allowed to do so, in my view. So that has certainly been my advice to the president.
I tend to agree more with the Elon Musk side of that, although not exactly always the most electric interview, I will say. Scott Bessent is the Treasury Secretary. He is you might say he's in the middle. I think in reality, he's not a tariff guy. But he has a spin on this that I think is instructive to a better approach than we've seen from some of the other officials inside the White House. Here's Scott Bessent.
A lot of our trading partners, including some of our allies, have not been good partners. If tariffs are so bad, why do they have them? Why do they have them? Right? Or if the American consumer is going to pay all the tariff, then why do they care about tariff?
Right.
Because they're going to eat them.
So he, more of a free trade guy. Typically, he's associating that rule there. Now, I would point out that one of the reasons we don't adopt the policies of failed other nations is because they suck. That's one of the reasons why we avoid them. We don't want to emulate European policies. There is obviously some appetite for that. He also talked in that interview about unleashing the American economy. And that part of the clip, I think, got cut off there. But like when you're talking about unleashing the American economy, it's not just from tariffs. I mean, that can help in certain areas at too great a cost. But also, I mean, if you want a company that's building stuff overseas to come to America, there's two ways to do it. We've done both. The Democratic way of doing it over the years has been tariffs, right? Trying to punish other countries so that, they have to come back over here and build their factories here. With, mixed record to say the best thing about it. The other side has been what Republicans have typically proposed, which is incentivize companies to come here, make them want to come here, give them incredible tax situations and regulation situations so they come here. They're coming here because they want to come, not because they've been punished to stay somewhere else. That is kind of back and forth of what we're talking about and we're seeing inside the administration. Now, Elon Musk has now kind of come into open revolt with some of these people, particularly Peter Navarro. Navarro is the biggest protected trade advocate, tariff advocate. He has been for a long time. Trump loves him. I mean, he loves his position on tariffs. He went to prison for Donald Trump, right? We know that he was punished and actually went to prison, came right from prison to the Republican National Convention. Remember that. Now, of course, he wasn't normally going to Republican National Conventions because he was a lifelong Democrat. But he's always been a big guy who really agreed with tariffs. He came out and did an interview where he said, hey, you know why Elon Musk doesn't like tariffs is because he's taking in all these, he's building all his cars with foreign parts and all these things. That is his spin on it. Elon Musk fires back and he says, Navarro is truly a moron. What he says here is demonstrably false. You kind of see how these things are popping out. Went on to call him all sorts of names and say, by the way, we are the most American-made car in the auto industry, which is backed up by a decent amount of reporting previously. Also, things are starting to be leaked about Dave Navarro. Dave Navarro is a musician, right? Peter Navarro is the guy in the administration. The top Trump administration economic advisor, Peter Navarro, made up an economist. He is quoted regularly in his books named Ron Vara. Tom Bartlett wrote this in the Chronicles of Higher Education. Those who know Navarro were fully aware that Ron Vara was a phony source who often popped up in his books. He said Vara was Navarro's alter ego, an everyman character who dispenses cutesy business aphorisms as well as dire warnings about Chinese food. Ron Vara happens to be an anagram of Navarro's last name. That's just one of the many interesting details about the character who Navarro once wrote placed short bets against the stocks of two nuclear power reliant companies 2 days before the worst nuclear disaster in human history at Chernobyl. So now we've got inside sources taking shots at people in the media. This is sort of a mess, right? The whole thing is kind of a disaster. And like when things go wrong, people point fingers. That's not that big of a deal. Not that many people, who cares? I think that you're seeing a fraying between Trump and Musk. That's something that media has died for over the past few months. It does seem to be a little bit of a separation there. But Trump really is loyal to these policies. He's believed them for a really long time. And it's unfair to say, oh, gosh, he's never done them before. What I think is fair is to say, hey, we saw what you did in the first term, which was a limited tariff regime, a targeted approach that hit certain companies and certain industries. And, you know, is there a little bit of picking winners and losers there? Sure. But at least there was an approach there that was kind of easily swallowed up into our economic advantages that we have in the United States. On the other hand, what we're having now is an overwhelming situation. We're going to go over this maybe next week about what the philosophy is behind all of this. And there is a philosophy. It's not particularly widely held, but there is one that he has he's looked at as a part of, and which it would reorder global trade in a way that, frankly, is something that if you've been a fan of this philosophy, you've been begging for years, right? Like no one, I mean, even go back into the era of like Pat Buchanan, people tried to do a lot of these things and were unable to get them across the finish line. Trump is there. He's in this position. He's very popular within the party. He has an ability to do a lot of these things because trade is one of the things that Congress has given the president power to do, despite what the Constitution says. So there is this way, this path for Donald Trump to do these things. And of course, we kind of all hope that they work out. Okay, I'm pretty skeptical that we're going to have great results out of it. But we also have to take that as part of a giant, it's like a cafeteria approach here. Yeah, there might be some foods you don't like at the buffet. That being said, the buffet might still be a good location, might be a good restaurant. And hopefully the things that are really good that he's doing that are kind of unquestionably beneficial for the economy, and there are many of them that we've discussed at length, can overwhelm some of the negatives that come along with a policy like this. We will look at this as we go on in the current week. It does seem like it's going to be a big story for a while, for at least as long as these last. You know, there are a bunch of countries that are coming to Donald Trump trying to kind of get on his good side and say, hey, actually, you know, maybe we can work out a deal here. If that's what this comes out to be, it'll be more of the Elon Musk approach, and maybe we can get some good results out of it. But we will see, looking forward, where this goes, and we'll watch it continually, even though it does seem like the most boring topic to talk about on a daily basis. Tariffs, not exactly sexy. This weekend, I'm going to be someplace. I'm going to be at a movie theater. I'm going to be watching King of Kings. Now, if you don't know the story, sometimes the most powerful stories can begin with just a few quiet words between a parent and a child, and that's King of Kings. It's a moment that kind of becomes the doorway into something much bigger. Through the eyes of a young boy, we're taken on a journey that brings the life of Jesus into full focus. From the joy of his miracles to the pain of his suffering, this film doesn't just retell the gospel. It helps you feel it. And that's something that kids need. It's a reminder of why the story matters. You know, it's not just your typical animated movie. The artwork is great. It's rich. It's immersive. The voice cast is loaded. Oscar Isaac, Mark Hamill, Kenneth Branagh, Uma Thurman, Ben Kingsley, Pierce Brosnan, Forest Whitaker, like a big Hollywood A-list type of crew. It's surprising they're working on a film like this, honestly. But they're heavy hitters, and they're telling the most important story ever told. The King of Kings is a perfect way to bring your family together this Easter. It's powerful, it's meaningful, and it's unforgettable. Pre-order your tickets right now at angel.com/stew. Angel.com/stew. Pre-order your tickets right now to King of Kings from Angel Studios. It's angel.com/stew.
Meditieren, Yoga, Joggen, nichts entspannt mich.
Echt? Mich entspannt meine Steuer total.
Steuer? Wie Finanzamt? Die Steuererklärung?
Ja, ich habe ganz locker über 1000 Euro zurückbekommen.
Hast du geheime Connections?
Nö, nur die Wieso-Steuer-App.
Wow, und das ist einfach?
Klar, die macht fast alles automatisch.
Plötzlich fühle ich mich so entspannt. Hol dir dein Geld zurück. Tiefenentspannt mit Wieso-Steuer.
I'm happy to welcome David Bahnsen to the program. He's the founder and managing partner of the Bahnsen Group, a contributor to National Review, and author of Full Time, Work and the Meaning of Life, a fascinating read wherever you can pick up your books. David, thanks so much for coming on the program.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Really appreciate it. Your book's great, and it takes on a topic that is like, I don't know, we don't take seriously enough, I think would be my end summary of this. It's fascinating because, you know, work, of course, is important when it comes to boring economics and productivity needs. That's all vital. But you kind of look at it as what it means to the soul. Can you kind of go into why you decided to write this book?
Yeah, you're exactly right. I do think it has tremendous economic importance. And I've studied this for about 25 years, the importance of labor productivity. But that doesn't animate me. In other words, it isn't what motivated me to actually write the book. It is existential. It is spiritual in the sense that I think we're talking about those things that fulfill mankind, that make the good life possible for us. And so we're living in a day and age when people talk about work as if it were the thing keeping people from finding real joy and meaning. This was a very Marxist idea that work was in the way of the worker being able to find true peace and happiness. And I believe work represents a path to a fulfilling life. That's what motivated me to write the book.
I mean, I think we could all kind of understand that as a feeling, right? Like we all might want to go on vacation, or we all want to spend more time with our kids, with our family. And work does sometimes get in the way of that. But I think if you look at it as this like barrier to actual life, you talk about in the book about work-life balance and how that's sort of a fallacy, right? Like it shouldn't be I have work sometimes and life other times. Work is an important part of life. And if we don't recognize that, we're not living to our full expectations.
Right. Work-life balance implies that work and life are at odds with one another instead of work being a healthy component and a vital component of life. It's the only thing, by the way, that we talk about as if it's in tension with the underlying thing of our life. Nobody has ever used the term marriage-life balance. Mm. They don't go home and tell their spouse, oh, I can't talk to you right now. I'm doing a little marriage-life balance. I don't think they'd try it a second time. So really, work has become something that we view as expendable, we view resentfully, and ultimately this era we're living in where there seems to be intensified alienation, anxiety, mental health issues, drug and alcohol abuse, depression. I accept that is true of the moment in which we're living in, but I don't accept that work is the cause of those things. I believe in many cases, work is a solution.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things you talk about early in the book is this, how we're spending our time these days. And we're not spending our time with other people as often. This is a really interesting cultural change. Derek Thompson has a great stat looking at the Time Use Survey and says that Now women, I think in their 20s, spend more time, active time, engaging with their cats than they do other human beings. This is according to the data that the women are providing. This is a massive change, and I don't know, it seems like it would follow pretty obviously that depression, anxiety, and all these other effects would follow right behind it. I mean, we've changed the way that humans interact completely.
And this is why I don't think the subject of work can be only understood in terms of economic data. That what you just described is an anthropological thing. It has to do with what we believe about the human person. And I believe the human person was made to be in community with one another, that we are made to have intimate and connect and true relationships with other humans. The animal kingdom cannot meet those needs, and most people intuitively know that. People love their pets, and all that is fine. But when you're talking about that deeper level of connectivity, we were made by God to be in relationship with one another, there's obviously the marriage relationship, there's children, but even socially, the communities we form. And when you start talking about work, you're serving those communities. You're producing goods and services that meet the needs to an external audience. So work all at once fulfills our internal existential purpose to be useful, and it does so by meeting the needs of others. It should be no surprise to us that in a humanistic framework that is very progressive, people not only are disinterested in what that means economically, they're disinterested in what it means spiritually. Mm.
You mentioned kind of the start of this being a Marxist belief, which of course leads me immediately to Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders is creating, he wants to create this, he's proposing a 32-hour work week. And it's one of those, you know, a lot of these policies sound great right off the top. We started the show today talking about the $20 minimum wage and why that sounds wonderful to most people. We're being nice to people, we're giving them more money, but the downstream effects of it are so negative. The same thing here, like I think most people would look at 32-hour week, wow, that's less than I'm working now maybe, it would be great, another 8 hours would be fantastic during the week, but like, obviously, the problem with the government implementing that is one side of this. But secondarily, is it the right move for us to be moving away from work more and more? I mean, is the goal to get to 0 hours of work eventually?
Well, therein lies the rub. Is this better for humanity? Is it better for a good life? And if you believe that mankind exists, as Marx did, as Rousseau did, and apparently as Bernie Sanders does, for leisure and recreation, then why stop at 32? Let's go all the way to zero. That's the thing about a 32-hour work week. It can't be created by policy, because just like the minimum wage, there's nothing you can do about the zero problem. Zero is always the minimum wage, and zero is always the hours worked if one cannot get or does not have work. Mm. It also can't be a maximum. Maybe government policy can say, I'm not allowed to ask my employees to stay more than 32 hours, but I'm allowed to stay more than 32 hours. Elon Musk is not going to stop at 32 hours. Jeff Bezos is not going to stop at 32 hours. So they say that they are so worried about wealth inequality and income inequality. Do they think that the entrepreneurs and risk takers and creators in our economy are going to stop at 32 hours? It's absurd.
Yeah.
The reality is that they are wrong on the most important philosophical piece. What brings us the good life? And what brings us a good life is not less work, it's more work, it's more useful activity.
What do you make of the idea of this, of a market solution bringing 32 hours? I mean, we have seen by the market a decrease in hours worked over long periods of time. I mean, there used to be 60 and 80 hours a week, and we have adapted to a different style. Is that bad that we've cut that much? And if we were to, let's say AI brings in a revolution that is productivity able to get us all the work that we need to get done in 32 hours, I mean, is that bad of a thing?
Well, here's the problem, is we're measuring the amount of hours that are worked, but we're not measuring the productivity. Mm. So here's my question. Why is the economy, with the cloud and with the digital computing and with AI and with the greatest technological advancements in history over the last 16 years, grown at 1.5% per year? And for 70 years before that, from World War II to 2007, we grew at double that, at 3.1% per year. So why are we getting no more output with greater resources and technology? Yes, we're working less hours, but we're not producing any more. And that, to me, is the trade-off. I want to see more productivity. I want to see more dynamism. That brings back jobs that we say have left. Those jobs are there. We have to be more mobile, dynamic in the way that we produce in the society. And ultimately, if it's true that AI is going to help us to get more done with less, I've written a few books. I wrote them all on a computer. My late father wrote several books in the 70s and 80s. He wrote them on a typewriter. So I'm all for getting more work done with less output, less, you know, sweat, if you will. But then let's actually take that through to its logical conclusion and get more things done that then allows us to move on to doing more still. That's the beauty of work. There's always more to be done in cultivating this great garden God has given us to cultivate.
Mm. Yeah, and you do talk about God and faith quite a bit in the book and its important ties to work. I mean, I think the worldly perspective is that faith and God and religion are at odds with capitalism, are at odds with profit, are at odds with working for money. That's like the bad side of life. You talk about this a lot in the book, that actually these, what we do and what we think of now as capitalism is really consistent with what we see in Scripture.
And it is true that I prefer the term free enterprise or a free economy, a market economy. I think that capitalism was Marx's attempt to use a pejorative, to make it sound like all we care is about capital, and that capital is a means to the end, but it's not the end. The end, I believe in, is human flourishing. And I think humans flourish when they are both free and virtuous. So I, in a lot of ways, I blame the right, because they have not defended capitalism the right way. We've talked about it in a greed is good context that is more atomistic and humanistic, where my defense of free enterprise is rooted to my love of humanity, my belief that God, it is faith-centered. God made us to be free and take advantage of our rational, reasonable, and creative faculties to do great things. For the government to come in and impede that and intervene in that is what I'm against. I'm against central planning and a progressive view of the economy for that reason. But it's not because I'm trying to accumulate more capital. It's because I'm trying to accumulate more goods and services that meet the needs of humanity. That's what output needs to be understood to be, a better life for all.
We got about one more minute left, David. Can you give me a minute on the modern idea of what retirement is?
It is very modern, because retirement for thousands of years was called death. and now, because mortality is longer, thank God, and because we have more prosperity as a society, the baby boomers entered the workforce with this idea that they'd one day be able to retire. And that was the first time in history. And I think it's a good thing that we have more flexibility and more freedom. But the idea that work is something you do for the purpose of not having to do it anymore is fundamentally false. And it's led to a lower view of work from the children that baby boomers had, millennials and so forth. And ultimately, I think that someone, look, at a different age and stage of life, people are going to turn down the knob a little, vacation more, spend more time with grandkids. But being totally removed from useful activity, I don't think that vision of retirement is a good one at all.
Mm. David Bahnsen, be sure to get a copy of the book. It's called Full Time, Work and the Meaning of Life, which is available now wherever you get your books. It's a great read and something that can change your perspective, not only on your day-to-day, but on society in general. David, thanks so much for coming on the program. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
So a New York mayoral candidate is proposing now pandemic-era monthly checks to, quote, end homelessness. This is the New York City Guaranteed for the Next Generation program. And it comes from New York City Council Speaker Adrienne Adams. One of the big, honestly, the only thing we know about Adams other than this is that she has the last name Adams, which is kind of an issue for Eric Adams. At least that's the thought. Sometimes people will throw in candidates that are just not even candidates with the last name that's the same. That's not the case here. She's the New York City Council Speaker. So she is theoretically qualified for this job in some way, if you happen to be a socialist. But that's an interesting thing. And that, we didn't get in any trouble when we were just sending checks to everyone. What could possibly go wrong? Definitely not inflation or anything. This is one of the most fascinating political things going on right now to me, just to watch this, because I'm not really in the middle of this debate or anything. I just found it to be fascinating. RFK Jr. is now publicly urging people to get the measles vaccine. I have a lot of, you know, good friends, people I really love, who are much more, you know, vaccine skeptical than I am, and really love RFK Jr. for the work he's done, kind of against vaccines over the years, warning people about them and you know, his activism over the years. And this is fascinating. I know our own Liz Wheeler was tweeting about this, saying that she was not happy with RFK Jr. and the way he had changed, seemingly, in his opinion. Now, to be honest with you, I haven't followed every word of RFK Jr.'s guidance on this going back, you know, a decade. I mean, I'm familiar. I'm much, you know, much more on his global warming beat, honestly, than his vaccine beat. But maybe he has been saying things like this, but I have not really heard it. He said, "We encourage people to get the measles vaccine." Kind of like open and shut there. The federal government's position, my position, is that people should get the measles vaccine, but the government should not be mandating those. Now, I happen to agree with him 100% on that. I don't think there should be any vaccine mandates at all. And that's something I've believed my entire life. I just don't think that that's the government role. They can recommend vaccines. They can perhaps have a role in making, you know, making it easier for them to be created or even distributed, as we saw during COVID. That was something that President Trump obviously worked closely on. Again, not everyone liked that effort, but I can see how the government theory would be involved in it. I don't think they should be forcing people to take it. I don't think, you know, local governments should be forcing people to take vaccines they don't want. You know, again, my body, my choice applies a lot more when you're talking about your body and not someone else's body that you're actually ending the life of. That's the abortion argument, by the way. Also, one piece of good news that I'm kind of excited about. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton is announcing a primary challenge against Senator John Cornyn. And it'll be interesting to see how many challengers he gets, if Ken is the only one. The one thing you may like, not like Ken Paxton, you may like him, but it's really more of a Cornyn thing for me on this, because honestly, like, John Cornyn is a senator that if he was from Vermont, I'd be very happy with. You know, he votes for, you know, generally speaking, some Republican things. He's not particularly conservative, not has a great voting record, but he's not, you know, Bernie Sanders. The problem is, this is Texas. You can have another Ted Cruz. You can have another real conservative in your state. Ken Paxton, I think, would vote very similarly to Ted Cruz. They are pretty much aligned on a lot of these issues. The other side of this is John Cornyn. And when you have a bright red state like Texas, when you can get a really good senator, someone who stands up for conservative values, you don't need to compromise. You don't need to have someone who's like, he's kind of with it. You don't need a Susan Collins in your state when you're Texas. It makes absolutely no sense. It's the most frustrating thing about it. Because Susan Collins is frustrating to me sometimes, but I can deal with her in Maine. I can handle it. Not Texas. John Cornyn should not be the senator from Texas. It makes absolutely no sense. Ken Paxton, or frankly, probably another million Texans could take that job and do a much better job than John Cornyn. But Ken is stepping up. He's a big name candidate. He'll have some money behind him and hopefully a successful primary challenge against Senator Cornyn. Anytime in life that you have to make a big change, it's hard. And this is especially true when you're planning to buy or sell a home. It is really complicated. It takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of jumping through hoops. And of course, the stakes are just about as high as they can ever get in terms of financial decisions that you make. So what do you do? Obviously, you need to have a real estate agent on your side that will help you with all of this. You don't just want some ordinary agent, someone who kind of does it on the side, someone who is not doing the best for you. RealEstateAgentsITrust.com kind of solves this problem. They do all the back work, all the legwork that you need. They pair you with the top selling real estate agent in your area. This is someone who knows the best practices, someone who understands the crazy housing market. Obviously, we're seeing markets go up and down like crazy. Someone who is a team leader, someone who's a closer, someone you can trust. If you're thinking about buying or selling a home or both, please get in touch with them. You'll see what I mean. It's realestateagentsitrust.com. The name kind of says it all, realestateagentsitrust.com. Check it out now. It's a free service to you, by the way. So, I mean, geez, take advantage of at least checking this out. It's realestateagentsitrust.com.
Unsere Empfehlung für deinen Podcast? Frisches Obst und knackiges Gemüse von Aldi. Immer gut, immer günstig, immer vielfältig. Kurz gesagt, frische für alle. zum Aldi-Preis. Diese Woche Zespri Sangold Kiwi. Das Stück für nur 55 Cent. Oder dunkle Tafeltrauben. 500 Gramm für nur 1,79 Euro. Entdecke jetzt viele weitere Angebote in deiner Aldi-Nord-Filiale. Und weiter geht's. Einfach lauschen und genießen. Aldi. Gutes für alle.
If you happen to be excited about brushing your teeth with 11 herbs and spices, I have terrible news for you. The fried chicken flavored toothpaste, introduced by Kentucky Fried Chicken, unfortunately, has sold out. You know, you think we're in economic tough times? Obviously not that tough. KFC toothpaste, here you go. I mean, it's in between the chicken nugget things they have there and some sauce, some barbecue sauce, I guess. There's a lot of things I'm willing to do in life. Chicken toothpaste does not sound like one of them. Just throwing that out there. But I don't have to worry about that because they are sold out. Also, we have climate activists have been found guilty of defacing Degas exhibit in National Gallery of Art. Edgar Degas has, they came and they put paint on it, and now they've been, they've now, again, it was put on, this is another thing they're doing all the time. They put the paint on the outside of a case. The case, I almost feel like they shouldn't even get arrested. It's a case. I don't know, replace the case. Well, it's a couple panes of glass. That's about all you did. But anyway, it didn't actually do anything to the artwork. That is the most important thing, but they are going to prison. I will say, too, you need to understand what your role is. If you're a climate activist, right, and you want to do something important in life, you need, of course, to glue yourself to something. Idiots gluing themselves to things is the only way to make a point about the climate. If you just go in there and put paint on it, well, you deserve to be arrested. Glue yourself to it, you'll be there forever. If it was up to me, I would just leave you there until you shriveled into a skeleton. And then eventually you'd fall out because your skin would deteriorate after your death. But that's just my approach. How much time do I have here, guys, by the way? I got time maybe for one more story. How much time, guys? About a couple minutes? Okay. All right, so let me give you this one. This is fun. A Nevada man has been arrested after his 7 emotional support tigers were seized from his home. Now, this sucks because he had emotional support. How is he supposed to have his emotion supported now? I mean, he had 7 of these. Imagine how disturbed he must have been that he needed 7. Here they are, by the way, pictures of the wonderful tigers. When you say tiger, it's like, oh, you know, is it like some baby tiger? No, these are full grown gigantic tigers who are just prowling around behind fences. Apparently that's not okay now. I mean, I don't understand. He was 71 years old. Let the guy have his freaking tigers, especially if he's keeping them behind fences. I mean, what could possibly go wrong? I will say it is a little bit like it would be a little bit of a turnoff on Tinder if you found out that you're going out on a date with someone who had 7 emotional support tigers. I think we all know the max number is 6, right? Like you should never go above 6 emotional support tigers. That's ridiculous. 6 is enough. 7, a little inappropriate. But that being said, does he really deserve prison for that? Keeping and feeding a bunch of tigers, keeping them alive? I just don't think that's appropriate. I think he deserves his freedom. Free the emotional support tiger guy. You know what? Give him an 8th. Free him, give him an 8th emotional support tiger, and then everything will be fine. What I'm holding in my hands right now, this is going to be shocking, is called a magazine. Mm-hmm. Real magazine. You can hold it in your hands. That's exactly what Frontier magazine is. This is the first issue of it. There's no pop-ups. There are no autoplay videos in this thing. This is just honest stories. It's beautifully printed. It is built to last. Blaze Media's Frontier magazine is back with issue number 2 now. If you missed this first one, you missed something special. Long-form features, rich visuals, stories that actually go deep. This issue that's new is going to go even further. It's a great thing to kind of just leave on your coffee table, too, when you're done with it. People will pick it up and read it. It looks great. You can't pick this up in a store. You can't find it on a shelf. You can't find it in your social feed, that's for sure. The only way to get Frontier is through Blaze Unlimited. This is like our highest level platinum membership, if you will. Blaze Unlimited gives you the full experience, early access to events, behind-the-scenes reporting, exclusive content, members-only merchandise, and a founding member's card as well, which is really cool. It's like thick metal. You like it. Plus everything in Blaze TV Plus. You get all the shows and all the stuff that you're used to. BlazeUnlimited.com/Stu is how you go and subscribe. This is not just about reading. It's about reconnecting with truth, with legacy, and with something real. It's BlazeUnlimited.com/Stu. BlazeUnlimited.com/Stu. Subscribe now. Be part of the movement. It's BlazeUnlimited.com/Stu.